Dr. Cook is not. I'm just kidding. I'm Larry. I'm at the University of Utah, and most of you are probably used to seeing me present about probabilistic linkage and the amazing, wonderful things you can do and how exciting it is, and talking about motor vehicle crashes. But it turns out life isn't all linkage and crashes, and so this is something that I do with another part of my work. I work with a group called PCARN. That's the Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network. And this is two large studies that they ran trying to implement two traumatic brain injury prediction rules into electronic health-based records to aid in clinical decision support. So the two PIs for the studies I'm going to talk about are Nathan Cooperman and Peter Diane. And if you looked at the title of this talk in the program, there's about 10 lines of authors, and it's because these are very intensive activities that they did, and everybody should be acknowledged. So PCARN is funded by HRSA. It consists of 18 emergency departments in the U.S. It's well established. It's been conducting research for over 10 years, and they've done all kinds of studies ranging from large observational studies to interventional trials to randomized control trials. And if you're interested in knowing more about PCARN, their website's pretty easy to remember. It's just pcarn.org. These two studies look specifically at the use of CT or CAT scans for children with TBI. Research has shown that by far and away children with minor head trauma are the most likely to receive a CT when they come to the emergency department. However, fewer than 10% of these CTs actually demonstrate a TBI. And so, you know, so what? So we did the test and it's negative. Well, there is actually some risk of exposing the child to radiation for conducting this test. And in many cases, the risk that's associated with exposing the child to the radiation is greater than the risk of that injury of causing TBI. And so to show you that this risk of CT scan exposure isn't negligible, there's been a lot of research looking at radiation exposure around atomic bomb blasts. And you can go out by radius from the epicenter of the blast to find the amount of radiation that was equivalent to a CT scan and look at the lifetime cancer risk associated to people that were exposed to that. And you can see that looking at brain cancers and leukemia and all cancers combined, this risk goes way up for kids. Once you reach an adult, you're not growing, your brains aren't dividing, or your brains, your cells aren't dividing quite as fast, and your risk goes down quite a bit. So the goal of the large PCARN TBI study was really to promote the appropriate use of CAT scans or CTs. And to do this, they wanted to come up with a way that had to minimize radiation exposure, but not really miss any TBIs. We could eliminate, you know, exposure just by eliminating CTs. So to do this, there was two prediction rules developed, one for kids under 2, one for kids who were 2 to 18. The reason there were the different age groups is for kids under 2, they're pre-verbal. They can't provide you the same kind of feedback about their injuries and how they're feeling and interact with the physicians and the nurses. There was a definition of a clinically important traumatic brain injury that was the main outcome of the rules. The clinically important TBI is one that's going to require some kind of medical intervention to cure you. And then the goal or the requirement of these rules was to have near perfect negative predictive value. So the study was conducted over 3 years. They enrolled over 40,000 children with blunt head trauma. It was a massive undertaking. Out of these 40,000 children, 15,000 received CTs. So a lot of CAT scans were given, but only 780 of those CTs showed a TBI. So this is just like what's been observed before. And even fewer of those had a clinically important TBI. But the decision rules worked out pretty well. The specificity was 97%, and the negative predictive value was almost perfect. So almost nobody got missed. Now, the sensitivity was around 60%, but that's better than where we're currently at. So the studies were done. They were written up, published in The Lancet, and everybody felt pretty great about having the research done. But, you know, the goal was to promote appropriate use of CAT scans. And you never know if just publishing your article while great on your CV, does that really get into practice? So the next obvious question was, how can we make sure that this information gets out into emergency departments and into practice? And the first idea that we came up with was we could print out decision rules and laminate them and send them all over the country, and that way they could be you know, stapled or taped to the wall in all the exam rooms, and if a kid comes in with blunt head trauma, the clinician or the nurse could simply work their way down the decision rule, and it would work like this. You'd get to box number one, you'd look at their GCS, you'd look for signs of altered mental status or a palpal skull fracture, and then you could say, oh, if that's true, I know their risk of a TBI is about 4.5%, and a CT is recommended based on the TBI rule. If not, you work your way down the different boxes and determine the risk and the recommendation. So that's really good, but you're still counting on those things to make it on the walls and to be looked at. So they wanted to develop something that was a little more hard to miss. And to do that, they wanted to actually implement this results of this study into the electronic health record and aid in clinical decision support. So the specific aims of this project were, one, to develop the tool, so and to pilot test an integrated EHR blunt head trauma data collection template and computer clinical decision support system to implement the prediction rules for children with blunt head trauma. Once that was done, the second aim was to conduct a clustered randomized trial based at the hospital level, where some sites would be randomized to obtain this rule and other, or the tool, and the other sites would, you know, get the regular laminated cards. So to get this to work in the ED, there's a lot of things that you have to go through. First of all, you have to get clinicians and nurses to accept the tool. And so lots of focus groups were held to figure out the best way to implement it, what kind of feedback they'd like, and the right way to present it. But after, let's just say you've got that all done, now you're faced with a child that has blunt head trauma, and you've entered all their data into the EHR. What we need is the EHR to feed you back the information from the rule. So it needs to let you know about the risk of TBI and the recommendation. And again, we're not trying to replace clinician judgment. The goal is really to augment their information and help them make a better decision. So this is an example of what the tool looks like. This would be at the triage nursing station. Patient comes in. If the nurse clicks yes, this is a blunt head trauma, when the patient's taken back into the exam room, the treating team would be faced with a screen like this, and you simply enter in all the variables that were part of the prediction rule as part of your exam, and it will come back and present you with the information. So here, for this set of variables, the results came back that the risk of a TBI is less than 1 in 5,000, and the rule recommends not to CT. So providing feedback right there real time at the patient level while but based on your research. So the current status, all the enrollment at all the hospitals is complete. The results of this analysis are currently confidential, and I'm not allowed to tell you. So I know. But this turned out to be insanely technically challenging. You know, the idea was that we could work with one targeted healthcare provider system of hospitals, and then also a subset that used Epic. And we thought, well, if you could solve it for one Epic installation, you could probably solve it for all. But that's not the case, because Epic turns out to be highly customizable, and everybody highly customizes it. And so a lot of time and energy ended up going into just making it work. But it is an exciting, I think, application for the EHR for us to get our research into practice and, you know, in the long run, as far as the study is concerned, reduce exposure to radiation for children that don't need to be exposed to it and possibly, you know, prevent some cancers at some point in the future. Before I finish, I need to acknowledge all the funding that went into this. And thank you. I'll take some questions. Yes. So, you know, we did a classification and regression tree, or a CART, and as part of the CART, you can develop surrogate variables. So if one of them's missing, you can find variables that either are correlated really well with it or predict it really well and look at those.
So do they have
Yeah, there is an unknown option. Oh, yeah. No, there's an unknown option. Yep. Yes?
Thanks for a great presentation. Oh, I wish it was yesterday when we talked about EMS and the perception, because I certainly see this applicable in triage. I mean, we talked about how EMS sometimes, or according to the author, not necessarily follow the protocol or guideline, but having something interactive similar to this that allowed prediction, whether this patient needs to go somewhere we want. So I guess my question, do you sort of see this more applicable in other fields as well?
I think it. I think that's a great idea, Sulaiman. I think, you know, just as Epic seems to be, you know, pervasive in hospitals, I think ImageTrend is the EMS software writer that is in a lot of states, and you might be able to work with the provider if you had an idea like this. I mean, if you can get the variables in real time and enter them, you can get the feedback. I haven't seen those studies. I don't know. It would be interesting to compare the results of those with the results of tools like this, and maybe they go together. Yes.
Have you had any qualitative feedback from the site on what the clinicians feel, how they like this tool? Are they willing to abide by it, or qualitatively? I mean, can't tell us.
That's part of the sequestered results.
Okay.
Yes. I don't remember the theoretical. It's in the paper, but I know that in sites where they laminated it anecdotally, not based on this trial, but talking to other hospitals where they got the rule, put it up on the wall, and trained their people on it, they felt CTs had been reduced. So, but I don't know about the hospital specific to this study. Yes. Like talking to my children. Can you tell me where you shopped for Christmas?
Well, the reason I'm asking is because there are a lot of people that want to implement these clinical decision rules in there, and I know physicians are complaining about how long it takes to, you know, treat a patient. Now, I told my cousin who works at Mayo Clinic, I said, my dad used to see 50 to 75 patients a day.
Yeah.
I just wonder if there's deficiency concerns or whatever.
I don't know. Okay, one more question. Then I want to invite everybody else back up for a chance for questions.
It's in the ED. I mean, I remember when I was in surgery at UBC, there was always a concern that
You know, that sounds like a great study. I know that was a concern with this study, and they were also concerned that if a patient was CT'd prior to arriving, that the medical team would already know the results, and that would bias their decision on whether to scan or not to scan. So those kids were specifically excluded from the study, but that is a really great idea. So, okay. Well, thank you very much. I want to invite Margie and Lee and Anna to come back up if there are any questions for them. Please.
What do you think will happen when the electoral power grid goes down in this country, which is predicted to occur? How will this impact going to appear as we move toward all electronic health?
Go ahead.
Well, I know we're required through our federal funding to have a disaster recovery site that is built in, and so ours is in Charlotte, so that if a tornado comes through Chapel Hill and wipes out the data center there, the backup is far enough away that supposedly it's safe. It's all powered by electricity, though. If the power grid goes down, our backup does have generator backup, but I don't know what happens when the generators run out of fuel. So.
I can actually speak to, for the vital registration, it's actually really important that it's electronic so the system can be moved. I mean, the way it is now, when Katrina came through here, it was pretty much a mess because the vital registration system was flooded. And the same thing happened in New York City with Hurricane Sandy. Actually, the vital registration went to an off-site place to do their vital registration because deaths keep happening even during a storm. So it actually is seen as a benefit, though, as everybody said, you know, if there's no power, I don't think anybody's going to be worrying about vital registration.
No, that's probably true.
Well, I often wonder that, too, about the, you know, we have so much data coming in now, and everyone's moving to cloud technology, so, you know, where are those stuff being stored? You know, apparently someplace very secure, but or maybe several different places and backed up and all that. But it's kind of a black box to all of us, you know, about this cloud technology. But it's definitely heading in that direction fast. So I think that someone hopefully has got it figured out.
At this point, they're separate flows. We have had several projects that have worked with linkage between ED and EMS and ED and poison. We don't have common identifiers, so it's not a real straightforward process, but there's a lot of interest in linkage. I will say that just the data use agreement issues around doing linked data in our state put people off, but there's interest and it is possible. Yeah, we do have some user customizable tools. It depends on the type of user, obviously. You have to have access to certain levels of data to be able to do that. But for instance, we have our chief complaint data go through some processing to, you know, can take the 800 plus ways that people say fever and convert it all to fever. And people can use those cleaned up chief complaints to build their own searches if they're authorized to have those data. And there are several other ways that they can customize it. I'm sure it's not as customizable as there are a handful of people who would like it to be, but for the most of our users, they seem to be able to get what they need out of it.
I wanted to make another comment, too, about what's going to happen with all these data? There are quite a few vendors out there right now, like SAS and others, that are developing tools for analyzing the data, visual analytics. And so I think that whole area of analyzing data in sort of a non-traditional way, we're still going to have the ability to do regressions and stuff, but to visualize the data and see what's going on is just the way of handling the data is just going to be totally different from what we're used to. I had a demonstration of visual analytics from SAS yesterday, and it's amazing. You just set your data up, and you just move it over into the viewing area, and it just sort of takes care of itself. You don't have to, like, go through and define things differently and combine things. It just does it all for you. You just click, and away it goes. So I think the analysis aspects of the data for big data is going to come along real well, too, as there will be such a need for it. People are going to take it on. And you won't have to be that knowledgeable about things, you know, that we'll be able to do some of this stuff without knowing a lot of statistical procedures. I know, you know, it's good to have the statisticians, you know, but some of this is going to be good just to look at it visually and see what's going on before you call on the statistician.
I just want to add, though, I think that you can get into trouble when people actually don't know their data and the tools allow them to do things and see things and they jump to conclusions about what it is they're doing and seeing and they have no idea what they're talking about. Yes, you can.
I'm not sure whether I said it. I meant to say it as the first thing in my presentation, but the goal ultimately is to have electronic death registration as the last entry in everybody's medical record. So the death certificate, when somebody dies, it would end up back in their electronic medical record. Now, this assumes that everybody has one medical record and all these kind of problems, but that probably will happen someday. This is like way pie in the sky, okay? But right now we have NDI, so that's the National Death Index. So if you have the, some information, you can, personal identifying information, you can match it to NDI. And NDI is being used a lot now by different healthcare providers to track who's died. Yeah. Well, that's why they're linking to MDI. So, but that's what you can do now. But I think it's going to lead to a whole bunch of new research into how, you know, post-hospital care, how often people are dying, when they're dying, you know, because sometimes it's not so long after they are discharged from the hospital.
But Dr. Warner, the question was getting that information in real time. And I think the issue with NDI is
right.
However, and you can probably
you have to know who to search for, too.
You have to know who to search for, but I think
that you know, it's unexpected mortality. It's not systematic.
So NDI is also being, the timeline for the file completion is being greatly shortened. So you'll be able to run it much quicker than a couple of years after the date of death. So if our data, the final mortality data is coming out like at the end, within a year, the NDI will be, you know, before that. And then you'll have to go back and do a follow-up to get completion. So, but it, you know, it's, that's the goal.
Okay, I think we're out of time for the session. So I thought this was great. I want to thank everybody for helping and presenting. But before we go, I don't know if you've heard, you probably have, that Lee is retiring very soon. And I just have to tell you, Lee, when I was first coming to APHA, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I knew that I like statistics and I like data. I just happened to be working with crashes. And I was not sure that I wanted to be in this section because there's epidemiology, there's statistics, who knows where I want to go. And it took me about 5 minutes of Lee, Lois, and Liz to decide this is where I belong. So it's been great working with you. Thanks a lot.
Well, I'm glad you came.